I just want to give you a very brief report. As I told you, my wife has gotten sick. We had a perk on Friday night. Her Valentine's gift to me. My Valentine's gift to her was all the gift. On Valentine's Day, she got me a very large sack of candy and a nice card, and I got her a pack of cash. I'm keeping up my pattern for which you can feel sorry if you like. Now, last week we began to talk about the preparation for talking about Revelation. And we're going to continue to talk about the preparation for talking about Revelation today. We may actually begin to talk about it a little bit, but most of it is still preparation. One of the things that we said today, we're going to cover. We're going to talk about symbols. And symbols, especially in what context, which particular kind of symbols? Numbers? Colors? Living? Creatures? And other things. That's what we're going to talk about today. We're doing this because, as we said last time, this book was written at a time of deep crisis. If you look in the Gospels, you look in the early part of the New Testament, what you see is the Roman Empire is neutral. There are places in the New Testament, there's one place in the New Testament that says, in the fullness of time, Christ came. A lot of people look at that time and say, the Roman Empire had put, if not peace, something close enough to peace on so much of the world at that point. People could move from place to place. There was a common language. Transportation was easy. And Jesus came in that moment, and it didn't last. 75 to 100 years later, transportation began to problem again. Language began to break up. And within a couple of hundred years, thankfully, we're back to almost barbarianism in the outskirts of the world. And you can almost see that change coming. By the time you get to Revelation, the Roman Empire is no longer seen as neutral. They're seen as an evil force that's in the country. And that evil force has begun to produce persecution for Christians. So the message has to be veiled in symbolism in part, simply because the writer wanted the people who were to read to understand what he was saying without having it intercepted by someone and have the message interpreted. So the message had to be hidden from anyone who isn't supposed to understand it and clear to those who are in the symbolic language. Now, it turns out there's another thing that happens as well. The second thing that happens is that in that culture, that was a reasonable and usual way of writing. We're used to Western things. And Western thinking is more prose-like. Eastern thinking is more poetry-like. Western thinking is more logical. Eastern thinking is more empathetic, that is, more feeling than thinking, if you want to use my Greek-type language. Western language tends to be more literal. Eastern language tends to be more figurative. Let me show you how this works. In our worship service this morning, we received a bulletin, we call it. Did you receive a bulletin? I noticed that they have gone to putting a small insert into our bulletin that gives an order of service for the traditional service. And you have an insert in on yours, I think. Everybody? I've seen it on Sunday. I have seen one of these for the contemporary service a couple of times. Maybe they were trying it out and they quit. I don't know.
It's been covered in the morning for a couple of times after college.
I know about that because we get those too. I've seen them twice, I think. I've never heard about everything. In any event, this was ours for this morning. And a couple of the people in the room were there. So I'm going to be true. What I would like to do is turn to page 3. And in page 3, there is a quotation of the words for the choir special for this morning. Let me read to you the first few lines. My faith, it is an oaken staff, a traveler's well-loved aid. My faith, it is a weapon stout, the soldier's trusty blade. A little bit later. My faith, it is an oaken staff, on it, let me lean. My faith, it is a trusty sword, that's the sword, he is a sword, right? A trusty sword may falsehood find it keen. Let me read you the first phrase again. My faith, it is an open staff. I will cause you to know it's not my voice. It's not my target. It's not me. It's open. Why is it open? Because it fits the leader. Mahogany would work. Dick is too short. Mahogany is too long. Open works. If my faith is an oaken staff, how long is it? Is it 4.5 feet tall? Is it 7 feet tall? Is it 3 feet tall? How big a mound is it? The Western mind will find itself bringing questions like that to language like this. And the bringing of questions like that to language like this can be, in some circumstances, I'm trying to set one before you now, silly.
The book of Revelation.
Simple. It uses figurative language. Should it be taken literally? Here is my answer. Definitely, maybe. And that is all that you can say. If you think it's purely figurative and there is no literal truth in it at all, you may find yourself at some point in the not too distant future surprised, beyond surprise, to find out that there's literal truth in it. If you think it's only literal truth and that you should try to figure out exactly how this works and exactly when that works, you're probably going to miss most of the time the book is trying to get you. What we're going to have to do is just walk a tightrope. And in that tightrope, look at the figurative and be prepared for the possibility that some or much or most or all of what is here has a literal meaning. I do have one conviction. Whatever that literal meaning is, you don't know what it is in its totality. And then you don't have any of the people who write about it. Whatever their knowledge is, their knowledge is incomplete. Whatever their certainty is not trustworthy. God is, but man is not. The possibility of literal meaning alongside of the clear certainty of some figurative meaning is there. And what we're going to do is try to walk down the middle. How are you going to look like? Okay? So, what we need to do is to begin to look at what meanings we can find that put us on this path. We're going to get into this in just a minute, but I want to tell you something first. The writer of Revelation gives a picture of life occurring in cycles. And the best place to see that exemplified in the Bible outside of Revelation is in the book of Judges. Now, all of you know the structure and form of the book of Judges, right? That's what I thought. A few of you may know a little bit about this, but I want to tell the rest of you. The book of Judges is fascinating and interesting. And I think I've got enough time. What I'd like to do is take you there just so you see one or two little things. You go to the book of Judges and you find the first chapter and the first verse. I want you to back up 5 verses. First chapter of Judges and back up 5 verses. That means you back up to the previous book for the last 5 verses. Everybody there? This is Joshua. It's chapter 24. Pretty good, wasn't it? Right? And you take a look here at verse 29. After this, Joshua, son of Nun, servant of the Lord, died. He was 110 years old. He was buried on the estate, and he received his heritage, and his name is where the place is. And then it says in verse 31, Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua, and throughout the lifetime of those elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the deeds which the Lord had done for the sake of Israel. There's sometimes when the Bible is so beautiful to understand, it just blows me away. How long did Israel serve the Lord? Verse 31. Look at it again. As long as Joshua lived. And as much longer as there lived people who knew Joshua and knew all the things that have happened. What is the clear implication? What is unstated? After that comes what they did. The book of Judges is after that. It's a wonderful phrase back in the early part of the Old Testament. And it says, Joseph had saved Egypt from the death of most of the citizens. And it says, they honored Joseph and they honored his family as long as they remembered what Joseph had done. But then there grew up people who knew not Joseph as the way King James did. And then that's when slavery came for the children of Israel. This is another challenge that people forget, and here come the problems. And when you walk through the book of Judges, this is what happens. Take a look at chapter 2 of Judges and verse 10. All it does is say it again, but in a different way. Chapter 2, verse 10. When that whole generation had been gathered to its ancestors, another generation followed it. Which one? They didn't know two things. They didn't know the Lord, and they didn't know what he had done. And verse 11 says it's consequence. What's the consequence? Did what was evil in the Lord of God, and when they did what was evil in the Lord of God, the Lord brought judgment. And when the Lord brought judgment, a few of the people realized the judgment was coming from God, and the judgment was coming because they'd forgotten God, and they remembered God, and they prayed to God. And God would send a deliverer. The term that's used for them is judge. So these were not judges in the sense of, oh yeah, like Jeff tried to start us out today. These are deliverer leaders, if you will. Leaders that God would raise up and bring them back once the revival had come. Or once the renewal had come. Okay? And what would happen was, the leader would settle the problems, bring them back to God, and as long as that leader was alive, what would happen? Things would be good, they'd be close to the Lord. That leader would die off, that generation would die off, and what happens? They go back in. Now, that continues through the whole book of Judges. Problem after problem after problem after problem. And the thing that sums it up is a thing that it is haunting to hear. There's a sentence that says, and they did what was right in their own eyes. Moses had told them way back before, when you get to the promised land, when the Lord is going to necessary to sell you into the promised land and to open up the space and to drive out the people that are before you, once that's over with, don't start thinking you did this for yourself. You remember the Lord. Don't you do what you think is right in your own eyes. You make sure you keep to what is right in God's eyes. And the phrase is Judges. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And the cycle changed. The writer of Revelation sees that. And the writer of Revelation sees that this is the plight of human beings. This is the way it will be until God intervenes for good and permanent change comes. And life becomes different on the other side of that cataclysmic moment. That's something you need to know when you read Revelation. Now, let's move to sentence. We got numbers. What are the numbers we have to know about? We have to know about 1. We have to know about 3. We have to know about 4. We have to know about 7. We have to know about 10. We have to know about 12. So let's start with 4. How many of you are old enough to remember the Heidi Disney show?
You remember how you
made it? There was an Indian Francis song. What was her name? It was Francis Summerfall Witherspoon. What does that represent? The what? How many people? It's also a hotel here. If something is scattered to the forest, somebody has traveled such a long distance, they travel to the four corners of the earth. What does four stand for? That's right. And those little things help you know that. The number four, is that all it stands for? Of course not. But that, when you see the number four, or you see four things, very often what you're, what the focus is earth. Four is not earth. The physical world. Or what you might call physical reality. Okay? If we were a Catholic church, or if we were saying about being creed, we might say, I believe in God the Father, God the Son, Trinity, right? What's three represent? That represents, interestingly enough, doesn't exactly represent God. One represents God.
Unity. Unique.
And what happens is writers of this kind of literature split between these two. This one means more the divine in a general sense, and in contrast the four would represent what? If this represents the physical world, this would represent the spiritual world. Now why is that important? Because in the spiritual world, Paul says we fight not against flesh and blood. We don't fight against flesh in the physical world. We fight against principalities and powers. What happens? In the spiritual world, there are forces of good and there are forces of evil. And so when you talk about the spiritual world, you're not necessarily talking about God, the good forces. But you're talking about spiritual forces, the spiritual world. This, almost always, when you see one or unity or other thing, is talking to something unique, something there's one of which God is the quintessential event. Quintessential, you didn't mind the words like that. How are you doing so far? Four? Represented? Yeah, it's probably better to say the physical world, but earth is not bad. Three represents spiritual world, and therefore, to the mind. And remember, in the spiritual world, you can't both good and evil. Good forces and evil forces. So what's the don't go so fast. What's the other? It's three plus four. So what does it represent? It represents everything. And because of that, it represents complete. Or, well, sometimes people will say it represents perfection. But that doesn't work.
Almost.
It's 7-1. Oh, now, let me go back to where I started. That was a Western world comment. Did you hear it? It was beautiful. Thank you for that. I heard a 5+1 over here from someone who's trying to back up the tail of things. It's almost 7. Almost. Almost completion, perfection. That's commentators who say this is the human number. And they look at things like in the Psalms where it says, you have made man a little lower than man.
Mm.
And you crowned it for an honor. So it's the human number. Some people say. So it also means incomplete. It also means imperfect. Well, let's bring it in. Figurative, certainly, and literal, maybe it's more certain than figurative. It's a little less certain that everything is exactly literal. Some of the ones that you say, well, maybe these aren't. Maybe they're the ones that are. We don't know. The writers of the books don't know. Some probably are more likely than others. You don't understand our numbers? So what's 10? What's 10? 10 is what? 10 is what? So what's 10 cubes? A lot of life. Okay, 12. Well, let's get the connections first. What are the connections in Scripture? 12. There are two big connections. One to the Old Testament, one to the New Testament. Go to the Old Testament. Five tribes of Israel. How many tribes of Israel were there? No, there weren't. Well, that's what everybody said. Joseph got two tribes. And Levi didn't get counted because Levi didn't have the portion of the land. Does that make 13? No, it makes 12. But wait a minute, that doesn't add up. I don't care. He has to hear this. If you go back and count Manasseh and Ephraim, get a tribe of peace. They get a portion of the land because Joseph got a double portion. Because the central role that Joseph played. Levi did not get a portion of the land. But Levi still counted. You get later on, and all of a sudden one of the tribes doesn't get counted at all, and you're back to counting Levi, and you don't count that tribe. How many tribes are there? The answer is always 12. Even when it's not, the answer is still 12. How many disciples were there? After Judas committed suicide, they had to have a vote to get a 12th one. And now they got Paul. And maybe Paul's the 12th one. No matter how you count them, how many disciples are there? Even when there's 11. Even when there's maybe 13. There's always 12. And what I want you to see is the number hangs correctly even if the Western mind starts to look into these problems with it. And my invitation to you is don't see the problem, see the number. What did you get saved? It's okay. Grade 1 4. Oh, no, where did you get 12? No. 3 plus 4. Yes. 3 4. Yes. 3 5. Okay. This is another everything number. But it's a special everything number because of the connection to the Old and New Testament. What is the special connection number? This is God's creation. In the Old Testament, they're called God's chosen people. In the New Testament, they're called the church, the called out. God's faithful people. What's the number that tells you that they're talking about this? The number 12. When you square 12, what do you get? 144. If they talk about 144, they're really talking about that. What do you got 144,000? There's lots of them. What is it, 144,000 as opposed to 143,999? Maybe. Likely? I don't know. I don't think that was likely. But boy, have some interesting groups fallen into hard times, trying to work their way around that. And I drive by one of the groups of them every once in a while. So when they reach the membership of 144,000, got that 144,001, they're going to be with the one. I don't know. If you hang that much on a number, you can get into trouble. Is that okay? Well, probably not.
Rome did not understand about that.
Well, if Rome doesn't know the Old and New Testament, it's pretty hard to figure this one out. If Rome hadn't had some idea of seven and things of that sort, they might have some trouble with people today.
And that's the
language sort of requires this kind of complexity. And yet at the same time, you don't want it to be too terribly. What do you want to do that next? Let's go to colors. What are we going to color? What are the colors we're going to talk about? Have you read the first 5 chapters of Revelation, which has been your assignment each week for the last 3 weeks? white, red, black, pale, green, purple. Interestingly enough, blue does not show up in their populist literature. I don't know if anybody knows why, but it doesn't. You read in the Old Testament, they're telling Moses how to build a tabernacle, blue shows up. I think beaver pelts or something like that is supposed to be dyed blue at certain points to make a training on something. Yellow doesn't show up. These two. Okay. So we got to look at these colors. Now, let me tell you what the color white stands for. Now, when I say this, with what certainty am I saying this?
Maybe.
It's a high probability, maybe. This looks pretty good. Don't hang everything on it, but you can hang most of it on it. White stands for triumph. Okay. And it always stands for triumph or victory. It sometimes stands for purity. Let me repeat that. White always stands for triumph or victory. Sometimes it stands for purity. Let me show you something. I want you to go to Revelation chapter 6. Probably you have a trumpet swallow at this moment. You're not actually looking at this. Revelation chapter 6. Verse 1. In my vision, I saw the Lamb break one of the seven seals. I heard one of the four living creatures, shout in a voice like thunder, come. And immediately I saw
a white horse.
I saw a white horse appear, and its rider was holding a bow, and he was given a victor's crown, and he went away to go from victory to victory. And when he broke the second seal, when the Lamb broke the second seal, I heard a second living creature shout, and here came another horse with another color. Let's go back and read about the white horse. What do you know about the white horse? Is that a rider?
On earth.
Yes. The rider had a military weapon, a bow. And the rider was given triumph. That's what the crown is. And he rose from victory to victory. So he's the rider. Why can't they drop something out there? Will say, well, that's Jesus. Rider on white horse, triumph and victory. Go to Revelation 20. Start at Revelation 19. And I want you to see a contrast in Revelation 19. Revelation 19, we're going to start in verse 11. Bring on with me. And now I saw heaven open and a white horse appeared. Its rider was called trustworthy and true. In uprightness he judges and makes war. His eyes were flames of fire and he was crowned with many coronets. The name written on him was known only to himself. His cloak was soaked in blood. He is known by the name, the Word of God. And behind him, dressed in linen of dazzling white, rode the armies of heaven on white horses. From his mouth came a sharp sword with which to strike the unbelievers. He is the one who will rule them with an iron scepter and tread out the wine of Almighty God's fierce retribution. On his cloak and on his thigh a name was written, King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Who's this writer? That's Jesus. Who was the first? You heard a sermon this morning if you went to the worship house. This sermon was about giants in the battle. Called the point four. He had 5 points in my hour. What was point four? Well, he had 5 in an hour. And the fourth point was, sometimes the giant wins. This is the rider in chapter 6. It's one of those giants. that we face. He was given a victor's crown, and he rose from triumph to victory to triumph to victory. Giants sometimes win. When the worship service was over this morning, I saw some people on the other side of the sanctuary that I hadn't seen for a while. So I made my way across the sanctuary and talked to them. The fellow who was the patriarch of that particular group slapped me on the shoulder and said, "You got any giants in your life?" And I said, "I got a couple." He said, "Well, I have victory over them now, aren't you?" And I said, "You didn't hear point four, did you?" He said, "Point four. What's point four?" You got into giants. Are your giants winning? That's what I'm dealing with. Life's not going real well. And I keep going ahead judging, and I'm not going to look in that direction. And you know what I'm talking about. Giants sometimes win. Quite a portion with riders are not always the Lord. What's the one number that everybody out there always knows? Six, six, six. What's the number six? Incomplete. Four. The human number. Why are there three sixes? It's not because there's lots of sixes, it's because there's three. What does three tell us? Divine in the spirit world, what does that look like when you look through it with this world? It looks like somebody human pretending to be somebody divine. This is the number of the counterfeit. What's the name that Revelation uses for it? Jesus used the same name. The Antichrist. Is the Antichrist an individual? What's the problem? Maybe. Some people are pretty certain about this one. Some people are absolutely certain about this one. I think the certainty is pretty high. But how many times have people been wrong so far? When they tried to assign it to a specific individual. Hitler was a great choice. When people said it looked like Hitler was probably the Antichrist, that was a great choice. And it doesn't look like it was wrong. It doesn't look like it was right, because the things that happened since then seem not to support that. But what is Antichrist? Antichrist is a human under the influence of this, pretending to something that only Christ has. There's only one Christ. So that's not a white rider. Do we move ahead? There was somebody sitting right here this morning who did that. They said the same thing. I think that is a brilliant and wonderful thing to say. I appreciate the thing. I was forgetting to say that. Yeah. At the end of a battle, sometimes people hold up white flags. What does that represent? It does not. It represents victory. You represent Victor. Who's Victor? That's all I know to say. That's all I know to say. I thought I came up with this morning and said, guess where this time came from? And I said, Thailand. I don't know why that came from. Does one win victory all the time? Well, I could quit that one and make it still come out that way. You know, it's not my victory, but it's just... Now, about that time, somebody over on this side said, well, it actually came in time of barbarians. It was a signal used because you couldn't see a black flag, but you could see a white flag across the battlefield, and that's the original victory. It's a beautiful Western mind. You're actually dead. I'm going to say, well, the Eastern side of the day, and embrace the idea that white represents somebody's victory. What's the difference between victory and triumph for the evil side and victory and triumph for God's side? The giants sometimes win wasn't the last point. What was the point that followed that? The giant sometimes win was point three. The victory
the end of the battle is always that God is the one fighting in the battle. That outcome is going to be tested. I think we made a different point with that. And I admit that for those of you who are sticklers for the details.
What does red represent?
Blood, which means?
It means war.
What color is the planet Mars? My community is what?
Red.
In the Roman and in the Norse and in the Greek mythology, Mars was the planet representing war.
That doesn't take too long. So what's black? What's black?
It is not dead.
That is beautiful. It's very important that you recognize that it's not dead.
Famine. And associated with famine is pestilence. And I don't think I'm spelling it right. What's pestilence?
The crops are running.
Pestilence means the crops are running. Black means famine and all the stuff associated with that. Hail means death. And the word is translated hail. Does your translation go back to Revelation 6 for just a minute? Verse 2, what color was the horse? It was white. Verse 3, what color was the horse?
Red.
Red. He was given this beauty to take away peace from the earth and set people killing each other. When he broke the third seal, I heard the third living creature shout, come, and immediately saw a black horse appear. The rider was holding a pair of scales. Basically, you can work all you want, all you get is a little bit of food. Verse 7, when he broke the fourth seal, verse 8, I saw another horse appear. What color?
Okay.
Anybody have any other words? One translation has the word passion. About a week ago, we had some people over at our house for dinner. Partway through the dinner, I experienced what is known as gastric distress. On a significant order, we caused me to retire momentarily. When I came back to the table, the people at the table looked at me and said, are you okay? And one of them said, you look pale as death. And another one, who was a nurse, looked at me and said, are you having chest pains? Are you radiating down your left arm? The color is not so much pale as it is the ashen gray of a corpse. The color is the color of a corpse. But the word you can translate is pale. Green is the color of life, and green is the color of one of the gates that John pictures in heaven. For the gate was made of an emerald, the color emerald. This doesn't just represent life, it represents eternal life. How about purple? Lydia was a seller of purple. And in the Roman Empire, only certain people could make it, and only certain people could buy it. Associated with war. Are there other colors that show up? Probably. Are we going to talk about them? No. But we've got 2 minutes left to talk about all the living creatures. So who are the living creatures? Did you see the women of men? When they were walking down the yellow brick road, and they were singing a song, not the yellow brick road, they were singing a song about living creatures. What were the first two words? Lions, tigers, and bears. Oh my. That's where our list starts. Lions, tigers, and bears. Oh my. We have goats, we have lambs, we have oxen, or calves, we have eagles. I'm not going to look horses up, but horses I don't think are often very symbolic.
forces are military power, and they're pretty much shown as that. They're pretty much shown. If you want to add horses to the list and just say military power, that's probably pretty good. But most of the commentators don't spend any time talking about it. There is also the face of a man, and there's dragons. Let's see what these stand for, and that'll be enough for one of those. Lion. What does Bert Lahr think before it's revealed that he is as cowardly as he is? I am the king of the forest. Every king of the beast. What's the evil? You may remember Franklin didn't want the eagle as a symbol for America. He wanted the turkey.
Right.
Assuming you don't know Franklin's reasons for not preferring the turkey to the eagle, how do you think of the eagle? Once you know his reasons, it's a little hard to keep the eagle in his place. This is the king of the beast. This is the king of the air, the king of the birds. I like the king of the air. I like that. King of the birds. The lion represents power. So does the bear. But this is overt. And this is covert. The bear is stinky. The bear is stuffy. The lion is up front. Now, the lion can also represent nobility. Noble. And I've got something to say. Always on power or strength. Sometimes on noble or nobility. Jesus is described as the lion of the tribe of Judah. And Peter says, Satan is walking around on earth like a liar, looking for him to devour. Both representing strength and power, one for good, one for oppression. How about tigers? Did you see the movie Gladiator? Did you see the moment in the place when the tigers came up out of the trap door? What does the tiger represent? Ferocity. Unbridled. The goat. Always represented evil or the mark of evil. The lamb, this one should be evil. Sacrifice. And I shouldn't say lambs because it's usually not plural. It's singular meaning, unique meaning, Christ. Okay. The eagle was the king of the air and the king of the birds. What did the eagle represent? Where do you meet the giant? Down in the valley. Where do you usually not meet the giant? Up on the mountaintop. When we think of mountaintop experience, it's a valley experience. But the psalmist didn't say, Gadar, I walked through the valley of exhilaration and happiness. All right. When we think of mountaintop, and the eagles are even higher than that, high spirituality. And the eagle is almost always positive. The lion can go both ways, more often positive, but not always. So in contrast, what's the ox or the cat? Patient service. What about the face of a man? Believe it or not, that particular symbol represents intelligence. I'm reminded of the spinster who once said that her life had been patterned after the words of Paul, I was not having you in my brother. Think about it. I was not having you in my brother. Paul didn't say that in quite that context. How about dragons? How about dragons? You take giants and multiply them by one of these thousand folds by thousand folds by thousand folds, and you've got dragons. Seemingly unstoppable, unopposable evil. That's the judge.
Your assignment for next time is to read the first five chapters of Revelation. That's still your assignment. Your assignment also is to find Ezekiel 1, verse 10, and read it and the context around it. And your assignment is to find Revelation 4, verses 4 through 8, and the context around them. And make sure you read those two at the same time. Ezekiel 1:10 and Revelation 4:4-8. I'm sorry, I say 4-8, I think it's 6-8, but the context is there. We will start at that point next time. Let's have a word of prayer to go. I thought of it sometimes in scripture that we tend to need a running start to start to talk about. But help us understand more than anything what we talked about this morning in the context of what we heard from the pulpit. Sometimes giants win. But we, like Job, are invited to study even though he's like, yet uncertain. Help us understand that you want to be with us wherever we are and whatever we're experiencing. And help us recognize your presence and take joy in whatever the outside circumstances. We'll pray all this in the name. Thank you.